Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Grandma, isn't there anything to do around here? 13-year-old Carrie complained. Boring, echoed 10-year-old Brian. Good grief, Barbara, their grandmother replied. What do you all do when you're home after school? Oh, Carrie began. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, I have dance. On Monday, there's soccer practice. Games are on Saturday. And on Wednesday, I have violin. Barbara took a deep breath. You certainly are busy. Me too, piped up Brian. I have Cub Scouts, soccer, guitar, and karate. My games are on Saturday, too. My goodness! Barbara sat down on the stairs beside them. It sounds like you have lots to do at home. Maybe we could try a nothing-to-do stay while you're here. The kids looked puzzled. That's the problem, Carrie protested again. There's nothing to do! Well, let's see, Barbara began. That pile of old boards has been sitting under that maple tree over there waiting for Grandpa either to use it or throw it out. Wonder what could be done with it. Brian's eyes lit up. Could I build a fort with it? He begged. Don't see why not, Barbara replied. Go find Grandpa. He'll have a hammer and some nails. By the way, Carrie, she looked sideways at her granddaughter, could you help me out in the kitchen for a bit? I thought we could use some of these fresh apples for a pie. Carrie's face brightened. Apple pie? That's my favorite. Then she frowned. But I won't be much help. I can only make frozen pizza. Well, then, Barbara responded, you've come to the right place. I need a hand in the kitchen, and you have two good ones. All right, Carrie exclaimed. There's always good stuff to do here. From a parent's perspective, how can we help our families to slow down and relinquish such frantic lifestyles? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest is Dr. Paula Sayag, the Early Childhood Specialist at the Partnership for Jewish Life and Learning of Greater Washington, D.C. She has worked in research, program design, and teaching. She has studied development of identity and self-esteem in children and the professional development needs of early childhood teachers. Her program design work has included creating and implementing systems to support needy families, promote strong individual identity in young families, and to encourage reflective practice toward excellence in early childhood education. She works with more than 40 Jewish early childhood centers, providing consultation, support, and training services. Dr. Sayag has three sons, ages 8, 11, and 14. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Sayag.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Someone once said that kids who are bored are kids who haven't been taught to entertain themselves. Do you think we're raising a generation unable to entertain themselves?
I think first we have to think about what it means to be bored. I think that word gets thrown around a lot, and people assume what it means, and children assume what it means. But children use the word because they hear it. And I think what a child means when they say, I'm bored, is I don't want to be here right now. I don't know what to do with myself. I'm not feeling comfortable. I'm not feeling relaxed. I'd rather be doing something different. I'm not satisfied. So it's not bored as in unstimulated or this is too easy for me. It can be bored as in this is too hard for me. I don't like this. I wish I was doing something different. I'm hungry right now. I don't want to play this game. So first you have to interpret what it means to be bored. It just means the child's not comfortable. Are they expecting to be entertained? Yes. Children are expecting to be entertained. We've structured their lives so much, so many of the after-school activities that you've talked about, so much of the television shows that entertain them, so much of the play that's given to them and controlled for them, even the toys they have that are not open but narrow. And this is what you do with this toy.
Can you explain what you mean by open and narrow toys?
Sure.
I'm picturing something that opens and then it shuts and it's very narrow.
I'm sorry. When I say that, what I'm thinking of is the toys that are prescribed and what you do with them. You push this button, you turn this knob. I'm thinking of a lot of the plastic toys with the very bright colors that tend to be flat. And then, you know, there's a button to push and a knob to turn and a wheel to turn and a knob to move up and down. But that's it. What I mean by open-ended toys are toys like blocks and building materials, even cups and saucers and Play-Doh that can become anything that a child can dream that they can become.
of the prefab toy houses with the curtains already in the windows and everything's
right.
painted and beautiful. And as we know, the kids love the great big boxes that everything comes in. And it can be anything. And,
yes.
you know, our houses both, when our children were growing up, had innumerable forts
right.
made of everything.
Isn't the best toy in the world the appliance box?
Absolutely.
The biggest refrigerator box or washing machine box.
Or
they
a very
should
large,
sell them.
Or a very large blanket draped over furniture.
Lots of blankets, lots yeah. of scarves, lots of towels, sheets,
right.
all of that stuff is the
linen
best.
Linen departments, are you listening?
That's right. Or remnants. My favorite is to go to fabric stores and go through the remnants and just buy big remnants. That's what I bought my own children, and I recommend for the dress-up, for dramatic play, as well as for forts and other things, and for Halloween costumes. Just drape them and connect them and cut them, and they're wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And shirts that are too frayed for certain husbands to wear.
That's right.
Just put them in the dress-up box.
Right. And big old cheap T-shirts that you can cut into anything you can imagine.
Right. How are all the enrichment activities that we provide for our children, like some of those mentioned in the story at the beginning, not good for them? Why is taking violin not good, or having Cub Scout meetings not good, or being on the soccer team or all that?
All of those activities, or most of them, have advantages to them. I mean, it's nice for children to see each other. It's nice for children to learn a new skill. It's nice for children to be exposed to things. What you have to think about is what's being taken away from the children. If they're doing all those things, what are they missing? And what our children are missing today is what we might call free time. But the value of free time. This isn't free time that's a waste of time. This is the most important time that educators imagine and that parents should imagine. This is time to truly play, to become what we call master players, to learn how to develop play scenarios, to build that fort and pretend that you're hiding in the forest and pretend that the other football team is coming and who's going to chase who and who's going to go where, and create these scenarios and build them and elaborate on them and get involved and continue them the next day and continue them with the next child down the street. Becoming a master player, developing that imagination, that creativity, that independent thinking, taking the initiative, learning how to be a leader, how to be a follower, how to negotiate conflict when Susie wants to be the mom in the family, but Brian wants to be the baby in the family, and you know, nobody wants a dog, and who wants pizza for dinner, and they're trying to work all of this out. This is where children learn how to be independent thinkers, gain self-esteem, be cooperative, learn how to negotiate, all of these skills that they are not learning when they're in a structured activity that is adult-led, where they're told just what to do at every moment.
Previous generations did have less structured free time. What advantages would you cite?
Well, besides the fact that the kids then learned how to, you know, be creative, think independently, try new things, risk-taking behavior, try on new roles and see how it feels to be the mom in the family or how it feels to be the teacher, the pretend teacher. Besides all of those things, they also got to learn from each other and over time. So the 3-year-old would learn from the 7-year-old and see what that was like and see how a 7-year-old negotiates and leads. But then when that 3-year-old becomes 5 or 6, they're then learning from a 10-year-old, if I do my math right. Those children are then at different developmental stages, and they're able to pick up different clues, different pieces of information, different ideas from that whole situation. So when you have a family that has more unstructured time together and a community that has more unstructured time together, the most wonderful is in the neighborhoods where all the kids are out and the 12-year-olds are playing with the 2-year-olds and the 6-year-olds are riding the bikes and the 3-year-olds are being pulled in the wagons and the 11-year-olds are climbing the trees, and how they all figure that all out together and how they watch each other. They get to do the same kinds of activities over and over again, so there's a lot of trial and error and risk-taking in a very safe environment. There's also a lot of mentoring and also a lot of learning at different developmental ages, which is so, so important.
This sounds like a recipe for profound social change.
It's very, very important that our families learn to slow down and that parents appreciate and understand and value what they might call downtime or quality time or unstructured time with the kids, and that the kids need it on their own. And we do have this sense of leaving our child behind if they're not taking soccer or they're not taking violin or they're not taking piano. And we have to fight it. It's hard. It's really hard, but we have to fight it and know that what's best for that child is just some time to create, to imagine, to dream, to act, to try, to fail, to succeed, and to figure it all out, to figure out how the world works.
And it sounds like we have to be modeling some of that ourselves.
Absolutely. Parents themselves have to learn to slow down.
Which is really hard. We
it's
have to
really
relearn
hard.
That whole thing. We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on slowing down.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Paula Sayag about helping our kids learn to slow down. Are there some tips that you can give of ways we can start to sort of get our kids to slow down?
Well, I have a new favorite book. It's called Einstein Never Used Flashcards. Are you familiar with that book?
No, but it sounds wonderful. We know about Einstein forgetting his socks. We use that in my house a lot.
It was written by Roberta Galinkoff and Kathy Hirsch-Pasek, and they talk about the importance of play and why children need to play. And it's a phenomenal book because it's very accessible. It's written for parents, but it lays out all the research on why play is so important. But what they start with is the formula that you're asking for. And they give us the formula, the new three R's: resist, reflect, recenter. Resist, reflect, recenter. First, you have to resist. You just have to say no sometimes. And it's hard. It's hard for me, and I believe this stuff, and I preach this stuff, and I find it hard with my own children, you know? I had to say no to a basketball practice this week, and it was hard for me to say no. My child's not going to an extra basketball practice at 8 o'clock at night, and I found that hard to do. But we have to resist and know what's right for our children. Then the reflect. Okay, what does my child really need? What does my family really need? What is going to work for us? Is this the best thing? Is this activity, this basketball practice, this violin lesson, this signing up for karate going to make a profound difference in my child's life that's positive? Is this necessary, important, more necessary and important than having playtime? So resist, reflect, and then recenter. If your answer to those questions is yes, you go and do the activity. If your answer is no, I need something else, you reorganize your life. It's going to take some action. We can get gobbled up in the hectic pace of our society, swamped and running here to there, and it takes real action to pull yourself back. It's very easy to just keep going, keep going, keep going, and before you know it, it's years gone by, truly.
It sounds like we also need to think of our family as a unit in addition to thinking of the needs of each kid. In other words, it's another concept that we have to be working with sort of
right.
at all times.
That's very true, and for so many reasons. So often we're separating our children from each other because one's running to soccer practice and one's running to ballet, and they don't get a lot of time together anymore. And if we want them to develop that love for each other through the sibling rivalry that's natural and expected and necessary, that's all part of it, but that's how they develop those bonds and that love. They need time together. It only happens through time. And I know of so many families, mine not being a total exception as I wish it was, where the kids don't have, if you really look through your week and think about how many hours were your children together, it's frighteningly little. And families and children together need time together.
I think that's one of the reasons there's so much renewed interest and emphasis on have dinner together, meals together, and things to do while you're doing that. Don't just sit down, let the kids gobble up their food and run.
Yeah. There's an article I read and a whole new term now being used called listening time, which is the whole dinner time philosophy. You know, turn the TV off and don't just gobble down your dinner, but listen. And all of the writings about at-risk behavior, risk-taking behavior, like in adolescence, the drugs and the sex and the alcohol and the things that parents are so rightfully so concerned about. How do you prevent that? How do you stop that? And they say that prevention of these behaviors begins at the earliest of ages. And how? Through listening time. It's all about spending time together, listening to your children, letting them know that you're there for them, that you're watching them, that you care what they do, and helping them to make independent decisions, not decisions that are based on what other people are doing, but decisions based on themselves, which is back to modeling also. What used to be called quality time together is sometimes now called listening time. We have to be careful with the term quality time, that it's not contrasted with quantity time, that we don't want to discount one for the other. Both matter a lot.
I saw an idea the other day that I thought was such a good one. I wish that I had known about when my children were little. The idea of having a colored napkin at the dinner table, and the colored napkin gets passed around, and when you possess it, you have the floor. Uh-huh. You can talk, and you are not to be interrupted, and then you have to pass it to someone else when you've shared whatever you needed to share about your day. But everyone at the dinner table gets that napkin at some point.
Oh, what a wonderful idea. There's also a little book called Around the Family Table, and it's a listing of a whole bunch of questions that are, you know, appropriate for certain ages and not others. And my children love to pull out that book and say, okay, my turn to ask a question. And it's out, and everybody has to answer it and discuss it. Everything from what would you do if you were president of the United States to what's your favorite color and why, and if you could, you know, go anywhere on vacation, where would you go? And questions that begin discussions, and that children then and parents have to listen to each other and respect each other's right to talk and time to talk and share about their thoughts and perhaps about their day, too.
Dr. Sayag, how would you answer those who say that daydreaming and digging holes in the backyard or climbing a tree are unproductive activities?
In addition to the general things I've said, that children need time to be creative, imaginative, independent, try risks, things like that, let's look at the three examples you just gave and what they might allow for. Daydreaming might allow time for conflict resolution. Usually in daydreaming, we're thinking about something that might have happened to us that day or recently, or could happen, and how would we handle it? We imagine ourselves in a situation. Children need that time. People need that time. You can't just keep going at a rapid pace and not have time to reflect. What we're learning about people in general and every profession in general, and this is true for teachers especially, is the importance of what we're calling reflective time. Time to think about, how did it go? What did I do? What do I want to do? Actually, my 14-year-old son just yesterday had to write a paper, a one-page little essay on a reflection. He said, Mom, what's that? He had done an oral presentation in history, and the teacher said, how'd it go? And he had never done that, and I thought it was so wonderful that the teacher had done that. But time to reflect and think, time to synthesize. So-and-so said something to me. Why could they have said that? How could I have responded? All of this is going on while you're daydreaming, planning time. Too many children today, adults too, don't know how to organize their own time because it's so controlled for them through all these activities. So when you daydream, you often think about, what would I like to do next? What might happen? How long would it take? You think through these things. You imagine possibilities. You plan for things. You dream. Digging backyard holes. Well, obviously, you've got the motor skills there. How wonderful is that? How hard is it to dig? Have you ever tried?
You should see our backyard.
You had four boys. You had a lot of holes. First of all, there's the plain physical exertion, which children need and is so wonderful, and the fresh air and the being outside. And then there's the seeing the nature, everything you dig up, and then what you do with that. It never becomes just digging a hole. Then you've got the worms and the rocks, and it becomes a whole play scenario and a whole game, and they're usually running around the holes and in between the holes and jumping into filling them with leaves. The creativity, the observations, the compare and contrast between two people's holes, between this worm and that worm, the discovering, the hypothesizing. How come that rock got embedded into that hole there? And why is that worm digging? The hypothesizing, that's what science is made out of. We want to create a generation of scientists. We need them. This is where it begins. Planning again and executing and accomplishing, the sense of accomplishment, that look on their faces when they finish that hole, get it as big as they wanted to get it. They can reach up to their knees when they stand in it. They're so excited. Figuring out the tools. What do I need to make this hole? No, let's try that. That one will work better. No, maybe both of us. And then the cooperation and the problem solving that goes into that. And then climbing a tree. Okay, so again, you've got the physical. But you've also got been planning. I mean, it's a lot of the same kinds of activities. Collaborating, helping each other, risk-taking. That's where climbing a tree is probably the greatest one with risk. How high can you get? How high are you willing to try? More today than yesterday. More at 3 years old than at 2 years old, or more realistically at 10 years old than at 8 years old. Trial and error and practice makes perfect. And that lesson of, if I practice, I can do it. And that look on a child's face when they say, I did it. Yeah.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on slowing down.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $10 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Paula Sayag about helping our kids learn to slow down.
Now, how do you prevent children using this wonderful, wonderful free time from doing things like video games or computer games?
That's going to be up to the parents. It takes a lot of strength on parents. As we said, it takes strength from the parents to say no to the societal pressures. It also takes strength on their part to say no to what their children think they want or are telling them they want. Children want to slow down. Let's say that first of all. When I thought about coming here today and slowing down and why don't we slow down, you know what? Kids want it. Kids are asking to slow down. They don't want to keep up this hectic pace. The parents have to put some controls on them. You asked me initially, are kids expecting to be entertained? And the answer is yes. Well, that's part of the video games. Perhaps they're playing video games because they don't know what else to do or how to do it. So it's going to be up to the parents to say no, and then up to the parent, like Barbara, the grandparent in your initial story, to help them figure it out. Give them some tools. Spend some time with them. But it's going to take some strength. You're going to be the mean mom that says no more video games. I wouldn't say no more. I'm not an extremist. But, you know, limiting, strongly, strongly limiting video games, television, computer time, all of that needs to be severely limited, and it's going to take strength on the part of the parents to do it.
And maybe say, today we're going to have a game day, or today we're going to have an outdoors day, right, or today we're all going to use these tools and do something special with it.
There's some commercial about once a week is game night, and
I've seen
each
that.
Person in the family gets to pick a game over the, you know, time period.
Right.
And so each week you're looking forward to playing the game and having the pizza or whatever is special.
Right.
It's a great idea.
It is a great idea.
The other thing that we found in our family was that when the kids had time to be on their own and sit in their rooms and daydream and all that kind of stuff, things came out of it, which I don't think is necessarily what you expect to happen. We had poetry come out of it. We had journals come out of it. We had family newspapers come out of it. We had music compositions come out. So things that were unexpected came out of that quiet time. How does this slowing down lifestyle work when the kids are teenagers and you can't say, turn off that video game, or you really want to say, so now what are you doing to make your college resume look a little bit better?
It's hard. There's nothing about this that's easy. It's so challenging for parents of teenagers where the teenagers are less responsive to the parents' demands, and you have that college pressure thing, talk about societal pressure, hanging over you. There's no question, but it's hard. And the only advice that I can give is, you know, back to the reflect, resist, recenter. You've got to make decisions day in and day out and over time what's best for your child and your family. Parents of teenagers do need to know that they still need to take control, and they can't give up that control. Teenagers need it. They want it. And as much as they might fight it, they're going to look towards it and respect it later. So first of all, the parents need to take control. Then they need to work with the child at the big picture. You know, this shouldn't be about, are you playing a video game now, or are you writing that paper now? This should be about, you know, what do you want to accomplish during your junior year of high school? And what kinds of activities are you interested in, and how are you going to get there? And it should be a discussion, particularly with a child of those ages, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th grade, of, you know, what is our life about? Just as parents in earlier ages need to sort of, one thing we talk about sometimes is have a mission statement. What are you trying to accomplish for your family? What are you trying to accomplish in your life? You can talk to adolescents, you can talk to younger children, but certainly teenagers about these things. And it's just going to take some real strength. There's a little too much pressure out there, to say the least, on the whole college resume thing. And it's just going to take a whole lot of willpower on parents' part and on children's part to say, do what's best for me. if this college doesn't want you because you didn't, you know, do 600 hours of community service and only did 200 hours, but you spent those other 400 hours with your family or reading a book or designing artwork or, you know, spending time with friends, what kind of a person are you? What kind of a person do you want to be? What kind of a child do you want to have? This is just a big, huge decision-making, planning, visioning experience that families are going to have to find the strength to go through. Because if we go through it day by day and give in to these societal pressures from the earliest years of soccer and karate and ballet to the later years of SAT preparation, we're going to be on a treadmill forever, and we got to stop it.
What resources would you suggest for our listeners who want to pursue this topic of slowing down a little further?
Well, I mentioned my new favorite book, which is called Einstein Never Used Flashcards by Roberta Golinkoff and Kathy Hirsch-Pasek. Great book.
Can you spell the last name so that
Golinkoff is G-O-L-I-N-K-O-F-F, and Hirsch-Pasek is a hyphenated name, H-I-R-S-H, no C, dash P-A-S-E-K. And then, of course, there's more standard books that I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with, The Hurried Child by David Elkind, and The Overscheduled Child by Dr. Rosenfeld. I think parents can find a lot of support in community institutions. I think that schools, believe it or not, teachers, guidance counselors, principals really know what's best for children, and they want to help parents, and they want to help parents think about it. The schools are not out there telling parents, go sign up for karate and go sign up for ballet. They're trying to help parents redevelop community, and that would be true, too, for religious institutions. And other such things. And I ask parents to look to each other for support. It's hard when Bobby down the street is taking all these after-school activities and you don't think you want to. Find the parents that are in your corner and find some support for yourself.
Well, Dr. Paula Sayag, you have certainly given support for every parent out there who is trying desperately to build a sense of community and individual worth in families and in our children. So thank you so very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our new book in collaboration with the HSC Pediatric Center. It's called The Little Book. It's a book for families with special needs children. Please call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and spell anything that isn't obvious, please. Mention show number 245. Tell us if you can what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into. Our other book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective and Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from the Bonneville International Corporation. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.